Diana, Ideology After Cancer. Diana was a devout conservative LDS member her entire life. That all changed when she was diagnosed with cancer while pregnant with her second child. Forced between staying alive and having an abortion, Diana's views began to shift. This is her story. Hey there, Diana. How's it going?
Hi, Jay. Doing pretty good. Doing good. Just chilling, I feel like.
Well, that's what Sundays are for, right?
Exactly. I'm like, love a lazy Sunday. So.
Yeah, same here. I'm excited to talk to you today, though, and this episode. I've done a poll on this episode, and a lot of people are interested to hear about your journey and see, you know, how your beliefs have shifted or changed because of everything you've gone through. So I'm excited to have you on this episode today.
Oh, good. I'm excited. I think that's for sure. It's been a wild ride few years, and yeah, would have never guessed, you know, that cancer would be part of my life or affect my faith, but it definitely has.
Yeah, so I'm excited to dive into that, and so you can share with us, you know, your perspective of life. So, I mean, I know you were diagnosed with cancer at a relatively young age. How old were you when you were diagnosed?
So I was diagnosed when I was 25, which is, I feel like, ridiculously young to be diagnosed with a cancer, but. Yeah, I was 25 when I was diagnosed.
Yeah, that's crazy. And what kind of cancer was it?
So I was diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia. Most of the time I just tell people when they ask what type of cancer I had, I just say leukemia, kind of explain. It's a cancer in the white blood cells. And yeah, but the community, we shorten it to ALL if you ever see that acronym. So acute lymphoblastic leukemia, but just for most people. And most people have heard of at least leukemia.
Yeah, and I think one of the most common questions people ask about that is whether it comes in stages, right? I'm sure you probably heard that a lot when you were first diagnosed. You know, what stage were you in? Is there any stages with that?
No, so not that I've ever heard of. And from my understanding, there's no stages for leukemia. Stages of cancer usually come with cancers that grow tumors, right? Like liver or pancreatic cancer. And if the tumor grows like relatively large, it usually becomes a bigger stage. Now, leukemia is horribly unique because your blood is everywhere. And so typically when you're diagnosed, your cancer is everywhere, right? There's no surgery you can do to remove your blood like you would to remove a cancerous tumor. And so like it usually goes from having like no cancer cells in your white blood to all of a sudden having a lot of cancer cells in your white blood cells.
Yeah, so it sounds like it's super aggressive. Like, how fast does this type of cancer spread?
Usually it spreads, especially by the time it's diagnosed. It's like, oh, you know, you need to be in the hospital right away. So for me, it was, and it's difficult to pinpoint the growth of this cancer. It's tumor that you can measure. So for me, the doctors guess that the cancer started developing shortly after Thanksgiving or around Thanksgiving. Diagnosed a few days after Christmas. So within the span of a month is when they think I had cancer or we had found it. And by the time I was diagnosed, almost 90% of my white blood cells were actually cancerous. So it went from like 0 to 100 real quick. So it is a very, very aggressive. Acute lymphoblastic is one of the fastest growing, most aggressive cancers out there. It will kill people within months if it goes undetected or untreated.
So it's something you definitely just got to hop on treatment as soon as possible, right? There's no trying to find natural healing. I mean, you could try to, but you're probably going to be dead by the time you're done finding anything that might actually help.
Yeah, apparently there's not really a good, quote, natural cure because it is so aggressive. The most common form of treatment is chemotherapy. I will just go ahead and note that therapies that you receive are derived originally from plants. So, you know, that was the first form of chemotherapy. I could make an argument that chemotherapy is actually natural, but most of the time it is produced in a lab now instead of we don't have to go out and harvest the plants like we used to. There's a certain type of periwinkle plant, for example, that they use a drug called, I believe it's vincristine, but that's where it originated from, was this, I believe, a Jamaican periwinkle. Quote me on that, but it is a type of periwinkle. I know that for sure. And they were able to derive a chemotherapy from that. Don't harvest it from there anymore. It's probably produced in a lab, but originally from a bunch of different plants.
Yeah, that's interesting. I also wanted to ask you about how aggressive that is, because a lot of people, when they hear, you know, your situation, I don't want them to judge you and think, oh, she should have tried something else. Like, yeah, it's all or nothing, right?
Yes, it's very aggressive. And I vividly remember doctors telling me that I only had a few more weeks to live if I did not do something drastic. And you, even if people do judge me, that's okay. But once you're sitting in that position and you're having several medical professionals tell you that you only have a few weeks left to live, you're gonna do what you can to survive a lot of the time, right? And so it's difficult to know what you're gonna do until you're faced with literally death at the age of 25, and you're like, oh shit, like this is so scary. I'm, you know, facing death right now, and I got to figure out what I'm doing with my life now.
Yeah, and you weren't alone. I mean, I know you had your husband, yes, kid, and you were pregnant at the time, right?
Yes. So we had a little son, and he was 18 months at the time I was diagnosed. And so we had very long. Me and my husband had only been married. We had just celebrated our anniversary the week before, like our third. I'm trying to remember. Our third year anniversary. So we had just celebrated our third year anniversary, and we had a little. We were expecting a second child, and when everything happened. So, yeah, it wasn't just my life to consider, but like, okay, like I wanted to be alive for my little boy and my husband, but mostly
yeah,
mostly my little boy. I really wanted to make sure I could be there for him.
Yeah. So let's I want to kind of know more about your life leading up to this situation, so people can understand, you know, what it might have been like to be in that dilemma. Because I feel like for people that weren't religious or that aren't religious, maybe the decision may have been a lot easier, but knowing you're a person of faith, I mean, I want to hear about that. So tell us about yourself, your upbringing spiritually.
Yeah. So I really had what I would consider like idyllic childhood, as cheesy as that sounds. I had extremely loving parents, great siblings. we were extremely faithful in going to church every Sunday, having family home evening back when that was more of like a requirement. It's a little bit more casual now, I feel like, in the church, but, you know, every Monday and read our scriptures as a family every single day. I remember there were times we would have to get up at like 5 a.m. because my mom taught seminary, and this was early morning because we weren't taught. So we would all get up super early before she had to go, and we'd read our scriptures together, say a family prayer in the morning, say a family prayer at night. And I would attend every single extra church activity there was, because church was extremely important to me growing up. Very, very important. It was, you know, following all the guidance in the my life. I even look back at journals right now from when I was in my teenage year. Every single journal entry, there's something, at least the ones that I have reviewed, there's something about church or something spiritual or something I've learned recently. And so my faith growing up was just everything to me.
Those that may not be LDS, which is, I mean, you're talking about growing up in a LDS or what they call Mormon household, right?
Yes.
So with that being said, like, it sounds like you were a typical Molly Mormon. Would that be a good way to describe you?
Oh, yes. Oh, 100%. I was sometimes, you know, people say like true blue Mormon is something I've heard more recently, but that definitely describes my childhood growing up. And I for those who know, you know, General Conference is, you know, when we all gather and listen to like the prophet and apostles, the church speak to us, and we would dress up in our Sunday clothes, even though it was a broadcast from home, and we would dress in Sunday clothes, and I would take notes from a very young age. My parents did loosen up a little bit later on, but it was, you know, very important for them and for me too. Like, it became a personal thing for me as well to be actively engaged in all aspects of the church.
And during this time, I mean, did you ever, did any kind of doubt slide into it, or are you pretty much like what we call on this podcast a validity Mormon? Like, you believed it was the one true religion?
You know, for a very long time, it was the end all be all. Like, I had no doubts, no doubts. I knew that I was going to serve a mission, and I knew that this was true, and everything I took at face value, no matter what. And I just, you know, I didn't have any concerns or any major doubts. Later on, I did start to kind of wonder about some of the things.
Like, how old were you?
I was in my 20s at this point. Turned missionary, so I had served a mission.
Okay, well, let me ask you this real quick, though. So, You wanted to go on a mission, and guessing around your age, were you wanting to serve before even the age change?
Yes. Yes. This was okay. Before the change. And I was like, going on a mission no matter what, you know, I would have to wait 21.
Wow. I just wanted to pause real quick on that, because for those that aren't aware or that are younger, so that before the age change, no woman really wanted to go on a mission unless, you know, obviously they clearly believed in it. Or, you know, they somehow made it to the age of 21 without being married, which is crazy in the LDS world, right? So at that point, yeah, they go on a mission. But before, prior to the age change, women can go at the age of 19. Prior to that, a woman going on a mission, it wasn't looked at as necessarily a good thing, right? So the fact that you wanted to go was, you definitely believed it true all the way.
Oh yeah. Like I knew I wanted to serve a mission when I was like 16 years old. I started telling people, I remember telling people like, I'm serving a mission. And everyone said, nah, you're going to get married way before then. And I was so mad. I was like, no, I'm going on a freaking mission. I don't care. I'm not getting married. I'm going to be a missionary. And yeah, so I would tell everyone that. And I went to school at BYU in Provo, and a lot of people were kind of surprised at how vehement I was about serving mission. They're like, you're so young, like you're 18, you're gonna get married off way before you can go on a mission.
Yeah, now I'm almost 30, so looking back now I'm like, holy cow, why did I ever think that was normal? Thinking that
yeah, I'm like, oh my goodness, getting married. And I still got married really young, even after and being what might be considered a spinster age at BYU. I'm like, oh, I was still so young.
Before we dive into your doubts and go to that part of it, though, tell us also about your political ideology growing up. Because from my understanding, you kind of went to some, you were a hardcore right winger, were you not?
Yeah, so I remember attending the George W. Bush rally with my brother and my brothers and my mom, and being so excited. And I remember chanting like 4 more years because I was so excited, you know, and a very, very Republican. I remember attending a, this is how much of a nerd, I guess, I am, as well as the political interest. But I had a very good friend, and we attended an economics camp together, libertarian people, and we were 17. So, you know, some kids go to something cool when they're 17 in the summer. We're over here getting scholarships to attend this libertarian camp where we literally spent the whole time, well, most of the time in classrooms talking about a very conservative, very, I would say probably more than classical libertarianism, but especially like economic policies. So.
Dang, so wait, give me a sec. Give me a sec.
Yeah.
Yeah, so sorry about that. I have some noise around here.
No worries.
So that's crazy. You were hardcore bought into that type of ideology. So
yes, yeah.
Well, and it's common because I usually feel like most LDS people, like when they're really religious too, they're usually bought into that. Let's be self-sufficient, you know. Abortion is bad. Mm-hmm. Help people have a hand up. Don't give a hand out. That sort of thing, right?
Yes, 100%. Like, my parents are extremely charitable people. They're very kind. They're very loving. But it's still like just the culture in the church where, at least where we were at, and even like familial culture was very conservative. Anything that was introduced by someone who was liberal or that was kind of like immediately dismissed or like, oof, this is not a good thing. Like, so I grew up very much not really understanding Democrats' points of view, but thinking like, nah, that's bad. No matter what they say, they're the party that's going to take away so much, and you know, they're terrible. So I didn't know any of like policies or anything about that. I viewed it very like, no, they're evil and we should stay away.
Damn. Yeah, and I was a lot the same way too. So it's crazy how life experiences end up changing that. So then tell us then. So you served a mission, and then you get home, and you begin to question some things. Tell us about that, and what led you to begin questioning and some of these doubts that arise after you served a mission.
Yeah, so probably serving a mission probably initially started a little bit of being honest. Like, I didn't really realize it at the time, but just like being exposed to so many different people who believe so many different things and who are just so incredible without being members of the church, very closed off to having a lot of friends or acquaintances outside. Whole social life revolved around members of the church. And so that was all my friends, all my acquaintances, even most of my coworkers, surprisingly, from that. And then I went to BYU where I was surrounded by that. And so my mission was probably the first time I was exposed to a lot of different people, a lot of different beliefs, and just I started to realize, like, wow, there's some pretty incredible people out here who don't have the gospel. And also on mission, I would like attend other churches because, if you go and you're a missionary and you're inviting people, like, hey, come to our church. And if they're religious, they say, well, how about I'll go to your church if you go to mine. And on our mission, we were allowed to attend churches as long as it didn't like interfere with our own like meeting schedule. So I attended some Seventh Day Adventist things or a Baptist like service and all these different churches, and I felt the spirit so strong in these other churches, and it kind of was confusing because the way I had believed prior to this was, no, like you feel the spirit most in our church, and because we have the full, you're gonna feel it the most in our church. So having these different exposures on the mission, I feel like was really important to kind of open my eyes a little bit. And then when I got home, I had a loved one, someone really close. Well, they were kind of forced out of the closet, but they came out and they were gay, and basically their whole plan was to kind of cut off contact with anyone who was involved in the church. And they were someone extremely close to me. And so after they had been outed and I had a chance to talk to them about like what they had gone through, being gay and being raised in the church, it kind of was like heartbreaking because that was the first time I'd ever and that I knew who's gay. And they were just super honest about as the suicidal thoughts they had had, the what how difficult it had been at church and hearing certain things. And that was probably the first time I took a step back and I said, something right here if this is how people are feeling. And then a few months after that, and who I taught on my mission, someone again like who I was pretty close to, they were gay and they had joined the church,
Like
being completely.
No, go on. Sorry.
Oh no, I was just gonna say they had so this so the close person to me once I was back from my mission had kind of come out, well, been forced out. They were out as an openly gay person, and then they had talked to me. And there was a gay person on my mission as well, who I hadn't really had conversations about the fact that they were gay. I just had conversations about the gospel because they were also a convert as well, this person on my mission. So we would go teach them like or like help them as a new member of the church. And so I'd been home from my mission for a few months when, and I'd been in contact with this person. And when I saw that they had taken their own life, and I knew that one of the reasons this person struggled so much because they were gay, and they just felt so depressed in, I shouldn't say that they took their life because they were gay. They felt so depressed and lonely in the church, according to the things they had told me and what they had left in their note, that they felt on, and they just didn't feel like they deserved to be here. And so those incidences were what kind of opened, like, instilled doubts. And I was like, okay, I feel right. I just don't think, you know, that the Church of Jesus Christ would be leading people to feel terrible about themselves. And yet, here we are.
Now, was this person, when I cut you off earlier, this is what I was going to ask. So the one that took their own life, was that the person from your mission?
Yes. So that was somebody on my mission, the good, like not the close person I knew outside of the mission.
And now, was this a person that you brought into the church? Like you taught them? No.
No, they had been baptized earlier, and then I met them. They had been in church for like 6 months by the time I was introduced to them.
Wow. So that's heavy. And then, so then how did it go? Like, did your doubts get you to become inactive, or how did you continue going to church at this point? And also, how old were you at this point? Because I want to compare that to when you got diagnosed with cancer.
I was about 23. I was about 23 when this started happening. And no, it didn't lead me to like church or anything. I did a lot more research into how to support members of the LGBT community. I went to like Provo Pride Festival or other things. And I really just tried to like reach out and be like, oh, you know, we need to be more loving. Like, you know, the gospel at its core is to love. So, you know, if we love, then that's the most important. And we can pretty much, in my mind at that point, it was like, well, we can love these people into feeling more welcome, even if they're not allowed to be married or have a relationship with someone they're attracted to. Like, surely if we love them enough, that'll be enough. So that's where I was probably at around when all of this was happening, at, you know, age 23 to 24.
Were you married at this point?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So did that make like your husband feel comfortable, or did you, because and this is for information for those that aren't a part of the church, but when you're going in to get a temple recommend, you get asked if you'd support any group, right, that is teaching or openly supporting things that are against the church's teachings. For me, and again, it's been a long time since I've been interviewed like that, but for me, I always took that as, because I think I had a bishop or stake president, I can't exactly remember, that said, you know, if you support gay rights, you fall into this category. Was that ever a conflict of interest, or a problem of interest, a point of conflict between, I guess, you and the church, or you and your husband, or did you just feel totally okay with doing, you know, being supportive of gay rights?
You know, I was so torn, because I felt very similarly to how you felt, that if I supported gay rights, not be worthy to go to the temple, because I'd be supporting someone who, like, in my mind, I was like, this group goes against the church. So I actually did ask a stake president in a temple recommend interview, and I was like, oh, I was crying. I said, this person who is so close to me, gay, and I want to support like the LGBTQ community, However, I feel like I can't do that. Like I'm so torn. And this state president was really good. And they said, definitely do that. It's fine. So I guess it depends on who you're getting your temple recommend from. Cause I still sometimes have like, oh, it depends on who you get it from and their personal interpretation. But for that state president, they're like, oh no, that's like, you know, if you were to join boycotts against the church, but the LGBTQ communities, they're not like actively against it. They just want to live their lives, and it's great to support them. And there's a lot of church communities that do support them.
So that's interesting, and lucky for you too, right?
Lucky at the time. It was lucky because yeah. So bad, but I do know that there are probably. And there have been and probably still are some leaders of the church who would have a different opinion than that particular leader.
Yeah, the last episode, or I guess two episodes ago, she got excommunicated for supporting that. So then that gives me a glimpse of where you're at spiritually, and sounds like you're supportive of those that, you know, the minority there, and that's Christ-like, but for those that are in the church, they can kind of see that conflict. But did you ever consider yourself as less of a member at this point, or no, then after you got that green light from the state president?
No, I did not feel, I honestly felt probably pious in my standing with the church. Like I was a primary president, which is like the leader over the children's, like the whole children's program at that point. I was 23 and I was like, look at me. I have this really, it's considered a higher up leadership position in the church. And so I was this primary president and I organized all the things relating to like the kids' classes and reaching out and really organizing stuff. So in my mind, I was like, I must be pretty spiritual and special to hold this calling, even with my support of LGBT people. I still was able to get this high. It's probably not a really high up calling.
Yeah, but you were like,
I was like, wow. And I get to attend all these fancy meetings with all the leaders of the church. And, you know, they're much older than me. They trust me to be this leader of all the kids. So.
Okay. So that gives me a good idea for what I'm going to ask next. So at this point, you're living life. You know, you got your husband, your child. And then you go and you, not that you go and purposely get it, but then you get diagnosed with cancer.
Yes.
What went through your mind the moment that you heard that news?
Well, that's a hard question. It's almost like nothing goes through your mind at first.
Mm-hmm.
And then so much. So I actually was at the OBGYN office. So I was really early on in a pregnancy, and we really, really had wanted this second child. We were so excited. We wanted a big family. We were pregnant. It was so happy. We had gone in right after Christmas for this appointment, and everything looked perfect on the ultrasound. Got to see the heartbeat, even the baby looked great. And they're like, okay, you're probably 12 weeks pregnant. We're just going to do the regular blood work. They usually do blood work at your first appointment when you're pregnant to check and make sure, you know, everything looks okay. And then they called me the next day and they said, you need to come in to talk about your blood work. And I remember that feeling. I did not know it was cancer at this point. I had no clue that radar, but I remember when the OBGYN office called me and said, you need to come in person to talk about this. Like my heart just stopped and I felt sick to my stomach. I felt horrible because I just knew this is not good. Like the tone of the fact that they said I needed to come in as soon as possible, I knew something was really wrong. And I think I kind of knew that I was never going to be able to hold this baby. And I remember we're sitting outside and our little, you know, toddler, I guess almost still kind of a baby at that point, only a year and a half. And we're sitting outside in the parking lot and I'm crying. I can't control myself because I just know something is terrible. And my husband is praying and he the Lord's will be done. So, you know, praying that everything will be okay, but, you know, thy will be done type of prayer. And I remember it didn't really bring me any comfort. I just kind of knew that no matter what, even if it was the Lord's will, it was not going to be good. So we went in and they got us in pretty quick and I'm still kind of crying. I'm trying to keep it together. And they sat me down on a stool. They're like, you need to sit before we tell you. And my husband has his hand on my shoulder and the doctor sits down and looks at me and really quickly and frankly tells me, you have leukemia. And I don't remember everything she said after, but I numb and just in total shock. I think my first questions to her were, what about, that was an early question I kept asking her. And she just said, I can't tell you that. Like, you have to go to this hospital. We've made arrangements. They're expecting you. Give them a call to see what you need to bring with you. But like, I can't tell you anything about, like, I have no idea. This is out of my realm of expertise. Like, you'll have to ask those doctors. And because I know a lot about cancer, but I knew enough that I knew chemotherapy was tough. And I was like, there's probably no way I could have a baby and go through chemo. So like, what about the baby? And in my mind, well, I also had a vague understanding that cancer could be slow. And I thought, well, maybe I could carry this baby to term and, you know, it'd be fine. And then I can start treatment. I had like a very vague understanding of what cancer looked like. And it ended up being quite different than anything I initially had thought.
Wow. Now, when you're in the hospital, at any point throughout this, did you have, with religion having been, you know, such a big part of your upbringing, was there anything where you went through and thought, oh no, this is God punishing me for supporting gay rights, or, you know, maybe I wasn't faithful enough in certain ways or whatever? Did any of those thoughts ever cross your mind, or
Surprisingly, no. Like, I've never had the thought that cancer was a punishment. Mm. That, like, I guess how my parents always framed trials was never punishments from God, but like just that bad stuff happened to good people. And so I never had that thought, not once. I never thought like, oh my God, I had done this different, or like, ah, God's mad at me. I never thought that.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's interesting, because a lot of people, that when they are taught a different way, right, they do attribute a disease or a hardship to disobedience, to maybe they weren't doing everything right like they should have. So I'm glad to hear that wasn't your case. That's I just had to ask that.
I will say that it's ironic, I guess, maybe a twisted version of that, but I had loved ones step away from the church at this point. Like, I had people that I loved leave the church. And at this point, I was still like, oh, they need to come back. They have to come back. And I remember sometimes talking with other people who were still active in the church and family members, and I would say things like, oh, you know, something's got to happen to wake these people up, the people who've left. Like, you know, if one of us died, or if like something serious, then they'd open up their eyes. Like, if I got cancer, I don't think I ever said like, if I got cancer, but it was very much along those lines. Like, it's going to have to go through something terrible in order to open up the eyes of the loved ones who had quote stroke. So maybe it wasn't me, maybe it was them. but I was punishing me. I if anything, I looked at it as an opportunity to bring back other lost ones with how serious this was.
Really? So, yeah, that is interesting. So, yeah, let's go back into those, you know, right before you start treatment then, because I'm assuming, you know, with how fast this leukemia grows, there is no option outside of abortion. Am I right?
You know, there really isn't, from what I understand. I have unfortunately seen other people in this situation who were diagnosed early on in their pregnancies with acute lymphoblastic leukemia. I've seen other people in this support group I was a part of were surprisingly in a very similar situation, and they chose to do, it's called immunotherapy. It's than chemo. It was not as harsh, so it allowed the baby to develop. And unfortunately, this woman and her child ended up passing away because the baby was born prematurely. The cancer had just progressed too far, because immunotherapy can only do so much with cancer, because it was, again, so mild. It wasn't really battling it. It was just kind of keeping it from killing her long enough, but it just, in the end, it didn't work out. And even though I didn't know that person personally, I felt it. It was pretty heartbreaking for me to see, because that I had made the other choice. I had chosen to have an abortion, and I was watching her journey virtually, and like wondering, okay, is this an option? Could I have done that? And like, did I make the wrong choice? And then I saw her husband posted updates that she had passed away, and I know that I'd made the right choice for me, and I'm sure she was doing what was best for her and her family. But it was still just so heartbreaking to see that it didn't work out for her. I don't know if it works out for other people in that situation. Hopefully there's not a lot of people in that situation. But for me, there was really no other option besides having an abortion and then quickly starting treatment.
I mean, and maybe if you're, I mean, is there, if you would have been like 8 months pregnant, 7 months pregnant, could you have just had the kid and then?
Yeah. At that point, even like 6 months pregnant, I probably would have said like, let's postpone it another 3 weeks and just monitor me. And yeah, 100%. But I was 12 weeks pregnant when I was diagnosed. Like I was in the hospital and I was asking all those doctors, what about the baby? And no one was answering. So finally one doctor had to say like, if you don't get treatment, you probably 4 to 6 weeks, like max 8 weeks to live based on how your cancer has progressed. But like 8 weeks would be really pushing it. And he did give the option, like, you don't want to have an abortion, but you want to start treatment, you can, but you will miscarry. And a miscarriage would probably kill you due to the loss of blood. Since, again, leukemia is a blood cancer, it messes with all of those blood cell counts, like your red blood cells or your platelets, which help with clotting. So their concern with me miscarrying would be that I would bleed out, essentially. And even in the abortion, which was in a room, it was not good. It went very poorly, even in a controlled environment. So their fear with a miscarriage, which is not in a, you know, sterile and controlled environment, would be I would bleed out. Yeah, it would have been bad. So I was faced with, okay, abortion, like, it's the only route. And it was, of all the things I went through with treatment, the abortion was the worst. It was the worst part of everything.
And that's saying a lot, because that type of treatment sucks.
It's extremely painful. Extremely painful. It's extremely long, and it's extremely, but like the emotional anguish I had with the abortion, plus, again, my abortion went horribly wrong. It was supposed to be 15 minutes, ended up being like 3 hours and a loss of blood. I believe they told me I lost nearly like 2 liters of blood, which is a lot. They had to give me like 3 emergency blood transfusions. I'm knocked out for all of this. I only realize this as I wake up. They had to give me a medication to stop the bleeding, and that medication made me incredibly sick for like 24 hours, and I was it poorly, which I do believe is because I had leukemia, and I doubt that the doctors who performed the abortion had. Well, no, I know they've never done it before, because they told me they've never done that to a person who has leukemia. It just, thankfully, I survived. They were like, it was a near-death experience. Like, this was not good. And so, yeah, it was quite terrible, but it was probably the emotional torment that was, is like, knowing that I had wanted this baby so badly, and the fact that I couldn't keep them was horrific. And knowing, like, I'll live with that. I know it was the right decision, and I'm really glad I made it. Still didn't make it any less heartbreaking.
And yeah, it makes me sad just listening to that. Now, I know, like, in the LDS culture, it's common to do, you know, pray about it. Is that something that you did beforehand that helped you have any sense of peace, or was it, or no?
Yeah. So right after I was diagnosed, they rush you to the hospital and you stay in the hospital. Which I was not expecting, but they're like, no, you're staying here for weeks. And I was like, what? Oh, we're in the hospital, me and my husband. And it's, you know, he didn't have any, he's very, very logical. And he was like, this is, and he was going into the field of medicine. So he's like, this is what the doctors recommend, this is what we need to do. And I was like, no, I can't do this. I feel like I would be, well, to put it bluntly, a murderer. I had viewed abortion for so long is that I was like essentially murdering a potential child. And I was so horrified that I would have to do that, like that it would be me doing it. So thankfully, I stayed up. You don't sleep a lot when you're diagnosed this type of, well, probably any cancer. But I was not sleeping for a long time. And in the middle of the night, I would just be praying or journaling. And I remember, I don't remember what general talk I was reading, but I just remember reading it and then very, very distinctly feeling this strong, the best way I can put it, but it was just very clear. You need to have the abortion. You need to live. It'll be okay. Like, this is okay. Like, you have essentially your Heavenly Father's blessing for this. So do it. And even though it didn't necessarily give me a sense of peace, it kind of made the decision. So I wasn't like, oh, I'm at peace, I'm zen with this. I still felt so sad and just, but I knew like this is what needs to be done. And I have my Heavenly Parents' approval to do, for lack of a better word. And so then I talked to the doctors the next day, because I think this was like 2 days after I diagnosed, and we had to wait on a doctor. There wasn't any qualified doctors to perform the abortion. We had to wait for them to get from their Christmas vacation. So I was just kind of waiting and trying to decide what to do. So a couple days I had that spiritual experience of this is okay. And then I told my doctors like, yeah, let's do it. Let's get started on the chemo.
Wow. Thanks for sharing that. So, I mean, you talked about how it was the hardest thing you've done. Like, afterwards, how did, like, what were the feeling? What are the feelings associated with an abortion after?
Probably still just a lot of processing. Guilt. Like, I still felt, because there was nothing wrong with that baby. That baby was healthy. And it was something wrong with me. Even though I didn't, you know, you can't control getting acute lymphoblastic leukemia. Most cancers, you don't really control getting them. And so it still felt like, okay, it was my blood. It was my body that betrayed me. And led me to this, and it's something I didn't want. And a lot of longing as well, because every milestone that went by, I would say this baby would be born today, or this baby would be a year old. Like, they'll do it years later, I'm like, this baby would be turning 4 this year. Like, and it hits me still this time. Not the guilt so much, because I've definitely processed, you know, that it was not my fault and that I did decision, but the longing for something that you wanted and that you almost now you will never have. So it's heartbreaking in that sense that I can't, that baby I never held, and I never will. And it's difficult to emotionally deal with that. And I did not for a long time. I just kind of pushed everything to the side and tried to survive a lot of chemotherapy. And then eventually I did get myself into therapy and had an helped me process a lot of different things. But that grief and that loss in particular. And even though I still feel the grief and the loss, I don't feel the guilt, because I know, like, I really, really do feel like that was the right decision for me.
Yeah. Now let's, I don't know. Are you running short on time? Do you only have like 20 minutes left?
No, we can talk for longer.
Okay. I was just wanting to make sure, because
yeah,
because no, after that, yeah, I appreciate your time. So after this abortion, I mean, the treatment, it's it's long, right? Two almost 2.5 years of treatment. From what I understand, it's the first 9 months of treatment are the hardest for sure.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
And that's it. And for those that, you know, they've never, I don't know, maybe they've never dealt with the U.S. healthcare system, but it's very, very expensive.
Oh, yeah.
To do treatment, right? How much do you think you were billed for in the first year?
A lot. Probably, I do remember seeing the hospital bills for a few of them, and it was like, well, like even just a hospital visit for a week, which I had to do, was like over.
Over how much?
There was one that was over $100,000.
Sorry, you cut out there on my end. What'd you say?
I was saying it's it was over $100,000 for one visit at one point.
Damn. So that, I mean, I'm sure that was, you know, a drop in the bucket, right? You just paid that off and walked away, or how did that work?
Yeah, poor college students living in the basement apartments. No, it was, we were lucky, I say, because we were very poor at that point, and we were on a lot of students usually qualify for Medicaid once they get married, and I do know that a lot of people, like I was 25, and we were my husband was in grad school and not working because that was a full-time actually. And I was working part-time from home, but not earning, just earning to, like.
Hey there, Diana.
Hey.
Hey, cut out, but I think part of it is because right now where I'm at, there's a snowstorm. So.
Oh.
Yeah, so you were saying, though, it's, I mean, it costs $100,000 a visit at some point, but you were, you guys were with Medicaid at the moment, at the time.
So we were poor college students living mostly off of student loans, to get through grad school, and all. We were poor enough, we qualified for Medicaid, which ended up saving us. So that was a huge blessing.
So, and then how was it being on the Medicaid for, I mean, two and a half years? Was it, because I know from my understanding, right, if you make over a certain amount, you get kicked off of Medicaid. So was there that fear of like, well, we just got to stay poor? How did that work out?
Yeah, it's a great system. Yeah, we had to be careful of money even was in our bank account, because Medicaid tracks that. They track that once you sign up for a program like that, you sign over your right to your financial privacy. They track account, and they if you have a certain amount over in your bank account, or if you start earning if you get a job, let's say, and you earn a certain amount, you will lose some Medicaid coverage. And so my husband was in school. He was not working. I was working a little bit, but a lot. Again, mostly student loans. So we even had to be careful with the amount of loans. Because if we took out too much in student loans and it went into our bank account, we would lose Medicaid. It would be devastating. It would financially bankrupt us. But, I mean, student loans pretty much did that anyways. That would have been way worse. So we, only took out enough to barely live off of, but be poor enough to qualify for Medicaid. And even my disability, which I applied for, because when you are diagnosed with that cancer, some cancers you can continue to hold down a job, but not leukemia. It is so intense that you're literally disabled for that time. And there were my treatment, I could not walk or barely move. And so you do qualify for disability. And once I qualified for disability, which was not that much for a family of three for disability at that time, it was, here is, I think it was like $750 a month at first to live off of, which is not a lot.
Yeah.
So I remember having to make a lot of phone calls to the Medicaid office and say, like, please, like, I need to stay on this. What can I do? Because I'm in the middle of treatment and the medical bills are huge. And if I do not have this coverage, then I will go bankrupt. And like, give me some guidance on how I can navigate these systems so that I'm financially ruined from cancer. And thankfully we managed to navigate and just had to pay, I think, I don't remember exactly how much it was out of pocket at the point, but it was, I think, less than $2,000 in total while we were on Medicaid. I was on Medicaid for most, and which was good because it was the really heavy stuff, those long hospital stays and those intense chemo the most. And then at the end of my treatment, I was on private insurance, which ball game.
Mm. And tell us about that transition, because I know you've mentioned to me in the past that is very expensive, even just to do like the last little bit of your treatment, switching to private insurance.
So we are lucky enough to, my husband has a great job now that has really good coverage, but it still is very expensive. You have to meet your deductible, like your max, and then all the out-of-pocket costs. There's a lot that goes into it. It's quite a system. Medicaid was nice because I was just like, even though that was complex, I didn't have to deal with deductibles or and so now we pay, you know, our monthly premium, and then I meet my deductible, which is which changes depending on the hospital I get procedures done at. So right now, I think we paid last year, which was solely follow-up work, so not procedures, because I'm done with treatment. So it's been just follow-up every like month or 2 months, and then about 6 visits a year, so every other month meeting with an oncologist. So just that alone to $7,000 for us.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's not a small amount.
Holy crap.
Yeah, but I think we capped out, because right now there's a cap. From my understanding, the affordable made it so that you can only go up to a certain amount. And I believe it's like it's around 7,000 or 7,500. And so we hit that. And that was only in the, that was just, follow-ups. That wasn't even active treatment. And even alone, this is crazy and a little side tangenty, but I just got a single bill from December that billed into this year. So it's a new year. So yay, they billed it. I need to kind of fight them on that too, but it was $1,000 solely and an appointment with an oncologist, $1,000 after insurance. Yeah. Our deductible, we haven't met our deductible whenever our stuff starts. So that's insane.
Well, so before I go on to the next question, though, I want to say thanks, Obama, for at least putting a cap on that.
Yeah. And I mean, to be fair, I was initially Republicans or a group of Republicans a long time ago who had this idea reforming healthcare. This was way back in the day when, you know, the political parties seemed to work together. And so I'm pretty sure it was a bipartisan group who initially came up with the idea. And then Obama, I think, signed it into law. And then, yeah. But thanks to everyone who made it possible, because I'm like, insurance companies would be charging cancer patients a lot more in their premiums, and they're not allowed to do that legally anymore. And they'd be charging us a lot more in, like, our that would be a lot higher. But
yeah, so how did that shift your political views, though? I mean, because like you said, you were really conservative, right? And now all of a sudden you are everything that libertarians don't like, right? I mean, you're using the systems that libertarians despise, right?
Yes.
Unless I'm misinformed there.
No, I think that's how I felt, is that I looked down on people who used government systems. And I remember being like, you're just system, you're taking advantage. And here I am taking advantage, you could say. And I was grateful. It kind of shifted my perspective. First of all, it shifted my perspective to be like, oh, this is really important here, so that people who are in positions like mine don't go bankrupt when they are diagnosed with a serious illness. And it gave me an insight into these systems are not easy to navigate. You're not really getting off of government assistance. And if you are, let me know how, because it was impossible from my perspective to barely survive. I was on so many different government programs just to get by. I was like, yeah, people aren't, and they were complicated. It was I spent hours taking time to learn how to navigate, and again, just to survive. And like when we were done with treatment, my husband had graduated and secured a job. We literally had $0 in our bank account. And so it's not like we were able to use government assistance or the disability I was on to get rich by any means. We just were living in a $450 a month and using government, like the WIC program, to get food and other things like that. It opened my eyes that, okay, everything I had thought about these government programs was pretty much wrong. Like, no, they're not set up. People aren't really taking advantage of this. People who are just poor, really, really bad situations, most of the time they're just using them to survive, because their situation would be way worse. And I started to be way more sympathetic to anyone who was on or anyone who was on Medicaid for any reason. So it started opening my eyes like that, to say, okay, maybe I was wrong about these government programs and the need for them. They actually do have a very and a role to serve.
So that's interesting. Yeah, it's easy to criticize. And I feel like, this is just my little tangent, I just feel like, hell, when people have lived a middle class or upper middle class lifestyle, they don't really understand, right, that like Yeah, no, people are just trying to survive, and yeah, they tell them, well, they should get an education and get ahead. It's like, well, how? Like, dude, there's no time to do it. You're working 40 hours just to put 40, I mean, sometimes 80 hours just to put food on the table. You're not gonna be able to sacrifice one to get education when you don't have the means to borrow or anything like that, you know, just to get ahead. But anyways, yeah.
Just, I agree with you. Like the, I did look at people like that. Like, oh no, you just need to work harder or do all these different things, get an education. And it's crazy because like our system, the how much more expensive everything is, people cannot afford to sacrifice like their meager income on, and a lot of times they might not even be allowed because of like how poor they are to get a loan or to do things that they want to do to pursue higher goals or dreams. And so you're kind of trapped in a system. And I definitely grew up middle, upper middle class. And even when we were poor college students, I always said it feels more like I'm playing poor because I come from like a upper middle class family that I never I could came to worse, I could rely on them and their wealth and they would provide. And thankfully we didn't have to do that. I always tell my parents like, be glad I didn't switch to your insurance because I would have cleaned out your bank account if I had been on your insurance and in treatment. Your retirement would have been gone. But yeah, I was on the government assistance, so thank you to people who pay their taxes because they went to keep me alive. And so I'm, you know, I look at taxes even differently. Like, okay, yeah, it could be annoying, but if it's going to a program that I support and something that I do feel like is a benefit, then I'm okay paying taxes. Like, willing to sacrifice a little bit of my money so that it can go towards helping people in need.
And did that shift your family's views as well? Like your parents, were they like, huh?
Probably not. I
No.
don't know. No, I no. They still conservative, especially financially speaking. One of my siblings is not anymore. I don't know if what I went through had to do with that or just their own personal experience. None of my siblings are conservatives anymore. We're all liberals now.
So,
So,
tell me about and tell me about how this affected your like changed your relationship with God. Because for me, and this is where I want to try to relate, for me, seeing, I mean, I you know, those that may not know from the podcast, but I also have cancer, right? And for me, that started this whole deconstruction phase where I was like, holy crap, I'm gonna die, and therefore, what if this isn't the only thing out there? Like, I mean, so that was kind of my perception. What went through your mind, and how did your views change?
yeah, I think really to you, like, oh my gosh, like when you're faced with the possibility of death, like some people say, ready to die or comfortable in my belief, and maybe they would, but I certainly wasn't, and I started to question a lot of stuff, like, okay, this is kind of what but like I guess I don't really know for sure. And so I had a lot of doubt. Like I probably of treatment. Like I did not go to church for a long time. This was pre-COVID time, my immune system was way too weak even to be exposed to like a normal cold. So we just went to church, and we didn't do anything religious. Like, I went from being such a religious person, feeling like this is how I connect to God is through my scripture study, through my prayer, through church attendance, to all this pretty much doing nothing. Like, maybe right at the beginning of treatment, I was like really praying and anguishing over the, but then a few months into treatment, I was just like, I'm done. Like, I'm going to stop. Like, I'm going to stop worrying about connect with God or trying to read my scriptures or trying to do anything. Like, I just, maybe I was angry, probably, like, mad that this would happen. Like, why me? All of those thoughts. And then I just, I just stopped everything religious. And to be honest, it was nice. It was really nice to have a break from all of this pressure I hadn't even putting on myself. And so I just kind of stopped everything of how I felt like I connected with God. Blank slate. So I'd stopped everything. And then I started to try to reconnect with God again, but in my own way. And so mostly it was a lot of yelling or crying in the car. As silly as it sounded, I would be driving myself to and from appointments because at this point I was past the worst of could drive myself home. And I would just kind of like yell at God and just, or just talk sometimes, but kind of rebuilding my relationship in a way that I didn't do before. A much more casual way, I guess you could call it. And yeah, so I started to look at God not in, like, I started to connect with God outside of the church, if that makes sense. So anything that I had like learned or connected within the church, I just was like, okay, I want to connect. If there is a higher power, I want to connect with them in my own way, on my own terms. And so I started to just say my little yelling or whatever. And I started to feel like I was building a more genuine connection, a connection and relationship with.
Wow. And with that, I mean, so did you like having rebuilt your faith, did it, was it still in line with like the truth claims of the LDS church? Like, this is the one true church, or how is your view now?
Well, it's different now. I do still go to church. I still go to the LDS church here locally. And I have a much more nuanced view of what my relationship with, I do see the church as a valuable, it can be valuable. I think it can be destructive, but I also valuable in building connections and relationships. But I do think there are some policies that can be harmful, or even just the rhetoric that church members use, almost like an us versus them. For anyone who is a member of the church, it's kind of like they're part of the world and they're not as good as us. And I'm like, well, I don't believe that anymore. I have a much more like, you know, I think, in my opinion, the God I believe in is going to be much more lenient and look at what people did with their lives and their actions and their hearts. And of people in the church, and I definitely have been and probably still am one of them that does not do nearly as much good as the selfless atheist who just goes out and serves and loves. And I'm like, surely would look at their actions and say, even though you didn't believe in me, you were still following the example of Jesus Christ, and therefore, like, are worthy to be in my presence. That's my own personal opinion. That's kind of how I look at it. I don't really think the church can be an amazing vessel and institution to connect you to God, but as a necessary part, if that makes sense.
Yeah. That does make sense. So would you say, I guess, are you still fully active in the sense that, like, you still pay your tithing, you still read your scriptures, do family home evening and all of that, or now you've kind of stepped back a little bit more and you're like, I go, but, you know, it is what it is. I just like the society I'm in.
You know, we still, tithing, or my husband does. I'm always like, well, I personally don't know if I would do money. I mean, it is our money, but he's like, I want to pay tithing. So I'm like, okay, we can do that. I think the church has plenty of money, if I'm being honest. They have quite an income.
Just 100 billion.
Just something that could perpetually grow infinitely unless something drastic happened. But I'm like, but it's okay. We'll pay. And just had a temple recommend interview not that long ago. And there's a lot that I do still live and a lot that I do still personally believe. I just now look at it like, this is my personal thing. And if there's something else that and they feel connected to God, then it is in no way my place to say, like, you're wrong, because people don't know my connection with God. And so how on earth would I know their connection? So I don't know, like a live and let be type of situation. And it's been great because I have a lot less pressure to, I don't know, live all the principles, I guess you could say. So I do what I do out of I truly feel this is right. And I always examine that. That's been a turning point from like cancer. I really examine, okay, am I reading my because I feel this weird underlying pressure because I was told I need to read scriptures every day to connect to God? Or am I reading my because I truly want to and because I truly feel connected to God, not from some weird social, from something that was said in a talk where you must read your scriptures every day or you'll regret it. And so I do, like, okay, am I attending church from pressure, or am I church because I truly believe it's the right thing to do? Or am I inviting this person because I'm like, oh, I should invite them, get them to church? Or am I inviting them because I genuinely like them as a person and think this would be a fun activity? So it's been an interesting of my faith as, like, what are my motivations behind my actions? Get rid of any actions from pressure from other people and truly focus on, how do I feel connected? And is this really serving me and serving that connection? And is it bringing me closer to Christ? The answer is yeah. And sometimes the answer is no.
So that's interesting. And I also wonder how much that has to do with, you know, the trial itself, or also just with maturity, you know, the fact that if you hadn't gotten cancer, do you think you would have, you know, reconstructed your faith like that? Or do you think cancer was the thing that made you reanalyze it all?
I definitely feel that cancer was list. I don't know, it made it happen much faster and much sooner. It's difficult to say if I still would have, you know, torn down everything I believed and rebuilt it or not. It's hard to say at this point, but I know for sure that cancer sped up the faith transition, all that deconstruction, just being faced with a deadly disease. You start to question things and like, what do I and what really happy?
Yeah, no, I've been there. And so with that being said, oh, I did have one more question. Do you still believe in the Joseph Smith story in the Book of Mormon?
Ooh, that is a good question. Ooh, that's a good one. So here's kind of where I'm at with that. I love the Book of Mormon. I definitely feel that it could be as accurate as like the Bible in Book of Scripture. There's things that I like about Joseph Smith, and there's a lot I really dislike, and there's a lot of things, for example, that I just personally don't think were from God. I just don't. I cannot. It does not feel right for me. Minded, no matter how hard I've tried, I'm like, sorry. I just think that maybe that prophets in the Old Testament or other things, that this was a man who, whether inspired power to take advantage. However, I do still think that God could work through people who are not great. So I always say, like, okay, even if God, would it really change how I'm living my life? And for me, it wouldn't. Like, it wouldn't. So it's kind of, it doesn't bother me too much to be like, oh, Joseph Smith, was he a true prophet? Or like, well, if he was a fraud, then I still like a lot of what came from the church. And I love the Book of Mormon. I like the way that I live the gospel. So maybe that's a cop out, but for me, I'm like, you know, even if there was irrefutable evidence that, you know, Joseph Smith was a fraud, I don't think it would change, because how I live very much based on my own individual stuff and not necessarily off of any rules of the church anymore. It's based off of what I feel is right. That's a good question, though. I fully, but
no, I like that, because that falls in line with the podcast being about nuanced Mormons, right? You're not like, you know, Molly Mormon cut out of, you know, just printed out. I don't know if you've seen the Simpsons episode. There's a Simpsons episode where I think they're printing Mormons and they just they run them through a printer and they come out as elders. Yeah, so I don't know. It's good to know that not everybody that goes to church is like that, right? Some of us go through some shit, some more shit than others. And we can come out of that and still be like, yo, I like the church, or I don't like the church. But not everybody that sits in a pew is thinking this percent the thing. I can't wait for my husband to have multiple women. You know, that's not everybody's thought.
No. And I do myself to, I'm going to stay in the church forever. Currently, going to church works. I don't know if that'll be. I am very much like, I wear a pride pin to church, that with rainbow and then the trans flag, because I want people to know I'm an ally. And I wear my pants to church because I'm a feminist as well. So kind of signaling to others, like, there's a different way to be in if you want it. So yeah, not everyone was or is what I was, you know, 10 years ago. But there's a lot of, I feel like there's a lot who do, who are more nuanced, and sometimes they just don't feel comfortable like expressing that.
Yeah. And it helps to have these stories out there. So I appreciate your, you know, I appreciate your time in sharing that. Is there anything that you'd like to add, you know, maybe to somebody that's going through cancer right now or questioning their faith because of a hard trial that they have in their life?
Well, for anyone who might be going through cancer or like a severe illness kind, whether that's like a physical or mental illness, I guess my advice would be like, kind and to be patient with yourself. Like, it's so easy, especially if you're a young person who is used to being independent and able to take care of yourself, and to suddenly go from that to being like physically disabled or struggling. Like, be kind to yourself. Like, it's not, whatever's happening, there's no help for any of these issues that might be happening in your life. So please be patient and please be kind with yourself. And in faith transition right now, just know that as painful as that can be as well, that you're okay. You're okay for doubting, and you're okay for feeling anger, and all of those emotions are valid. And I guess that's the same advice, to be patient and be kind with yourself. Don't be mad at having your doubts. Don't feel guilty. It's easier said than done, but just try to be patient and kind with yourself and with as well.
Well, I appreciate that, Diana. Is there anything else you'd like to say or have anything left to say before we wrap this up?
Thank you so much. What you're doing is incredible. And, yeah, it's always great to talk to another cancer homie, and especially one who is in the church too. It's nice to have, like, oh my gosh, we have, you know, very similar in terms of like what treatment is like, and, you know, having like a crisis of your faith, but then also like a buildup of something great. So. Just, you're doing great.
All right. Well, I appreciate that, Diana, so much. I hope you have a great Sunday.
Thanks. You too.
All right. See ya. Bye.
Bye.